been answered. But from another, they are as open as they were when this essay began. It is not only the scientific community that must be special. The world of which that community is a part must also possess quite special characteristics. And we are no closer than we were at the start to knowing what these must be. That problem, what must the world be like in order that man may know it, was not, however, created by this essay. On the contrary, it is as old as science itself, and it remains unanswered. But it need not be answered in this place. Any conception of nature compatible with the growth of science by proof is compatible with the evolutionary view of science developed here. Since this view is also compatible with close observation of scientific life, there are strong arguments for employing it in attempts to solve the host of problems that still remain. Postscript, 1969. It has now been almost 7 years since this book was first published. In the interim, both the response of critics and my own further work have increased my understanding of a number of the issues it raises. On fundamentals, my viewpoint is very nearly unchanged. But I now recognize aspects of its initial formulation that create gratuitous difficulties and misunderstandings. Since some of those misunderstandings have been my own, their elimination enables me to gain ground that should ultimately provide the basis for a new version of the book. Meanwhile, I welcome the chance to sketch needed revisions, to comment on some reiterated criticisms, and to suggest directions in which my own thought is presently developing. Several of the key difficulties of my original text cluster about the concept of a paradigm, and my discussion begins with them. In the subsection that follows at once, I suggest the desirability of disentangling that concept from the notion of a scientific community, indicate how this may be done, and discuss some significant consequences of the resulting analytic separation. Next, I consider what occurs when paradigms are sought by examining the behavior of the members of a previously determined scientific community. That procedure quickly discloses that in much of the book, the term paradigm is used in two different senses. On the one hand, it stands for the entire constellation of beliefs, values, techniques, and so on, shared by the members of a given community. On the other, it denotes one sort of element in that constellation, the concrete puzzle solutions which, employed as models or examples, can replace explicit rules as a basis for the solution of the remaining puzzles of normal science. The first sense of the term, call it the sociological, is the subject of subsection 2 below. Subsection 3 is devoted to paradigms as exemplary past achievements. Philosophically, at least, this second sense of paradigm is the deeper of the two, and the claims I have made in its name are the main sources for the controversies and misunderstandings that the book has evoked, particularly for the charge that I make of science a subjective and irrational enterprise. These issues are considered in subsections 4 and 5. The first argues that terms like subjective and intuitive cannot appropriately be applied to the components of knowledge that I have described as tacitly embedded in shared examples. Though such knowledge is not, without essential change, subject to paraphrase in terms of rules and criteria, it is nevertheless systematic, time-tested, and in some sense, corrigible. Subsection 5 applies that argument to the problem of choice between two incompatible theories, urging in brief conclusion that men who hold incommensurable viewpoints be thought of as members of different language communities, and that their communication problems be analyzed as problems of translation. Three residual issues are discussed in the concluding subsections 6 and 7. The first considers the charge that the view of science developed in this book is through and through relativistic. The second begins by inquiring whether my argument really suffers, as has been said, from a confusion between the descriptive and the normative modes. It concludes with brief remarks on a topic deserving a separate essay: the extent to which the book's main theses may legitimately be applied to fields other than science. 1. Paradigms and community structure. The term paradigm enters the preceding pages early, and its manner of entry is intrinsically circular. A paradigm is what the members of a scientific community share, and, conversely, a scientific community consists of men who share a paradigm. Not all circularities are vicious. I shall defend an argument of similar structure late in this postscript. But this one is a source of real difficulties. Scientific communities can and should be isolated without prior recourse to paradigms. The latter can then be discovered by scrutinizing the behavior of a given community's members. If this book were being rewritten, it would therefore open with a discussion of the community structure of science, a topic that has recently become a significant subject of sociological research, and that historians of science are also beginning to take seriously. Preliminary results, many of them still unpublished, suggest that the empirical techniques required for its exploration are non-trivial, but some are in hand and others are sure to be developed. Most practicing scientists respond at once to questions about their community affiliations, taking for granted that responsibility for the various current specialties is distributed among groups of at least roughly determinate membership. I shall therefore here assume that more systematic means for their identification will be found. Instead of presenting preliminary research results, let me briefly articulate the intuitive notion of community that underlies much in the earlier chapters of this book. It is a notion now widely shared by scientists, sociologists, and a number of historians of science. A scientific community consists, on this view, of the practitioners of a scientific specialty. To an extent unparalleled in most other fields, they have undergone similar educations and professional initiations. In the process, they have absorbed the same technical literature and drawn many of the same lessons from it. Usually, the boundaries of that standard literature mark the limits of a scientific subject matter, and each community ordinarily has a subject matter of its own. There are schools in the sciences, communities, that is, which approach the same subject from incompatible viewpoints. But they are far rarer there than in other fields. They are always in competition, and their competition is usually quickly ended. As a result, the members of a scientific community see themselves, and are seen by others, as the men uniquely responsible for the pursuit of a set of shared goals, including the training of their successors. Within such groups, communication is relatively full, and professional judgment relatively unanimous. Because the attention of different scientific communities is, on the other hand, focused on different matters, professional communication across group lines is sometimes arduous, often results in misunderstanding, and may, if pursued, evoke significant and previously unsuspected disagreement. Communities in this sense exist, of course, at numerous levels. The most global is the community of all natural scientists. At an only slightly lower level, the main scientific professional groups are communities: physicists, chemists, astronomers, zoologists, and the like. For these major groupings, community membership is readily established except at the fringes. Subject of highest degree, membership in professional societies and journals read are ordinarily more than sufficient. Similar techniques will also isolate major subgroups. Organic chemists and, perhaps, protein chemists among them, solid-state and high-energy physicists, radio astronomers, and so on. It is only at the next, lower level, that empirical problems emerge. How, to take a contemporary example, would one have isolated the phage group prior to its public acclaim? For this purpose, one must have recourse to attendance at special conferences, to the distribution of draft manuscripts or galley proofs prior to publication, and above all, to formal and informal communication networks, including those discovered in correspondence and in the linkages among citations. I take it that the job can and will be done, at least for the contemporary scene and the more recent parts of the historical. Typically, it may yield communities of perhaps 100 members, occasionally significantly fewer. Usually, individual scientists, particularly the ablest, will belong to several such groups either simultaneously or in succession. Communities of this sort are the units that this book has presented as the producers and validators of scientific knowledge. Paradigms are something shared by the members of such groups. Without reference to the nature of these shared elements, many aspects of science described in the preceding pages can scarcely be understood. But other aspects can, though they are not independently presented in my original text. It is therefore worth noting, before turning to paradigms directly, a series of issues that require reference to community structure alone. Probably the most striking of these is what I have previously called the transition from the pre- to the post-paradigm period in the development of a scientific field. That transition is the one sketched above in Section 2. Before it occurs, a number of schools compete for the domination of a given field. Afterward, in the wake of some notable scientific achievement, the number of schools is greatly reduced, ordinarily to one, and a more efficient mode of scientific practice begins. The latter is generally esoteric and oriented to puzzle solving, as the work of a group can be only when its members take the foundations of their field for granted. The nature of that transition to maturity deserves fuller discussion than it has received in this book, particularly from those concerned with the development of the contemporary social sciences. To that end, it may help to point out that the transition need not, I now think should not, be associated with the first acquisition of a paradigm. The members of all scientific communities, including the schools of the pre-paradigm period, share the sorts of elements which I have collectively labeled a paradigm. What changes with the transition to maturity is not the presence of a paradigm, but rather its nature. Only after the change is normal puzzle-solving research possible. Many of the attributes of a developed science, which I have above associated with the acquisition of a paradigm, I would therefore now discuss as consequences of the acquisition of the sort of paradigm that identifies challenging puzzles, supplies clues to their solution, and guarantees that the truly clever practitioner will succeed. Only those who have taken courage from observing that their own field, or school, has paradigms, are likely to feel that something important is sacrificed by the change. A second issue, more important at least to historians, concerns this book's implicit one-to-one identification of scientific communities with scientific subject matters. I have, that is, repeatedly acted as though, say, physical optics, electricity, and heat must name scientific communities, because they do name subject matters for research. The only alternative my text has seemed to allow is that all these subjects have belonged to the physics community. Identifications of that sort will not, however, usually withstand examination, as my colleagues in history have repeatedly pointed out. There was, for example, no physics community before the mid-19th century, and it was then formed by the merger of parts of two previously separate communities, mathematics and natural philosophy, physique experimentale. What is today the subject matter for a single, broad community has been variously distributed among diverse communities in the past. Other narrower subjects, for example, heat and the theory of matter, have existed for long periods without becoming the special province of any single scientific community. Both normal science and revolutions are, however, community-based activities. To discover and analyze them, one must first unravel the changing community structure of the sciences over time. A paradigm governs, in the first instance, not a subject matter, but rather a group of practitioners. Any study of paradigm-directed or of paradigm-shattering research must begin by locating the responsible group or groups. When the analysis of scientific development is approached in that way, several difficulties which have been foci for critical attention are likely to vanish. A number of commentators have, for example, used the theory of matter to suggest that I drastically overstate the unanimity of scientists in their allegiance to a paradigm. Until comparatively recently, they point out, those theories have been topics for continuing disagreement and debate. I agree with the description, but think it no counterexample. Theories of matter were not, at least until about 1920, the special province or the subject matter for any scientific community. Instead, they were tools for a large number of specialists' groups. Members of different communities sometimes chose different tools and criticized the choice made by others. Even more important, a theory of matter is not the sort of topic on which the members of even a single community must necessarily agree. The need for agreement depends on what it is the community does. Chemistry, in the first half of the 19th century, provides a case in point. Though several of the community's fundamental tools, constant proportion, multiple proportion, and combining weights, had become common property as a result of Dalton's atomic theory, it was quite possible for chemists, after the event, to base their work on these tools and to disagree, sometimes vehemently, about the existence of atoms. Some other difficulties and misunderstandings will, I believe, be dissolved in the same way. Partly because of the examples I have chosen, and partly because of my vagueness about the nature and size of the relevant communities, a few readers of this book have concluded that my concern is primarily or exclusively with major revolutions, such as those associated with Copernicus, Newton, Darwin, or Einstein. A clearer delineation of community structure should, however, help to enforce the rather different impression I have tried to create. A revolution is, for me, a special sort of change, involving a certain sort of reconstruction of group commitments. But it need not be a large change, nor need it seem revolutionary to those outside a single community, consisting perhaps of fewer than 25 people. It is just because this type of change, little recognized or discussed in the literature of the philosophy of science, occurs so regularly on this smaller scale, that revolutionary, as against cumulative, change so badly needs to be understood. One last alteration, closely related to the preceding, may help to facilitate that understanding. A number of critics have doubted whether crisis, the common awareness that something has gone wrong, precedes revolutions so invariably as I have implied in my original text. Nothing important to my argument depends, however, on crises being an absolute prerequisite to revolutions. They need only be the usual prelude, supplying, that is, a self-correcting mechanism which ensures that the rigidity of normal science will not forever go unchallenged. Revolutions may also be induced in other ways, though I think they seldom are. In addition, I would now point out what the absence of an adequate discussion of community structure has obscured above. Crises need not be generated by the work of the community that experiences them, and that sometimes undergoes revolution as a result. New instruments like the electron microscope, or new laws like Maxwell's, may develop in one specialty, and their assimilation create crisis in another. 2. Paradigms as the constellation of group commitments. Turn now to paradigms and ask what they can possibly be. My original text leaves no more obscure or important question. One sympathetic reader, who shares my conviction that paradigm names the central philosophical elements of the book, prepared a partial analytic index and concluded that the term is used in at least 22 different ways. Most of those differences are, I now think, due to stylistic inconsistencies, e.g., Newton's laws are sometimes a paradigm, sometimes parts of a paradigm, and sometimes paradigmatic. And they can be eliminated with relative ease. But, with that editorial work done, two very different usages of the term would remain, and they require separation. The more global use is the subject of this subsection. The other will be considered in the next. Having isolated a particular community of specialists by techniques like those just discussed, one may usefully ask, what do its members share that accounts for the relative fullness of their professional communication and the relative unanimity of their professional judgments? To that question, my original text licenses the answer, a paradigm, or set of paradigms. But for this use, unlike the one to be discussed below, the term is inappropriate. Scientists themselves would say they share a theory or set of theories, and I shall be glad if the term can ultimately be recaptured for this use. As currently used in philosophy of science, however, theory connotes a structure far more limited in nature and scope than the one required here. Until the term can be freed from its current implications, it will avoid confusion to adopt another. For present purposes, I suggest disciplinary matrix. Disciplinary, because it refers to the common possession of the practitioners of a particular discipline. Matrix, because it is composed of ordered elements of various sorts, each requiring further specification. All, or most of the objects of group commitment that my original text makes paradigms, parts of paradigms or paradigmatic, are constituents of the disciplinary matrix. And as such, they form a whole and function together. They are, however, no longer to be discussed as though they were all of a piece. I shall not here attempt an exhaustive list, but noting the main sorts of components of a disciplinary matrix will both clarify the nature of my present approach and simultaneously prepare for my next main point. One important sort of component I shall label symbolic generalizations, having in mind those expressions, deployed without question or dissent by group members, which can readily be cast in a logical form, like X times Y times Z, Phi, XYZ. They are the formal or the readily formalizable components of the disciplinary matrix. Sometimes they are found already in symbolic form. F equals MA, or I equals V over R. Others are ordinarily expressed in words. Elements combine in constant proportion by weight. Or action equals reaction. If it were not for the general acceptance of expressions like these, there would be no points at which group members could attach the powerful techniques of logical and mathematical manipulation in their puzzle-solving enterprise. Though the example of taxonomy suggests that normal science can proceed with few such expressions, the power of a science seems quite generally to increase with the number of symbolic generalizations its practitioners have at their disposal. These generalizations look like laws of nature, but their function for group members is not often that alone. Sometimes it is. For example, the Joule-Lenz law, H equals RI squared. When that law was discovered, community members already knew what H, R, and I stood for, and these generalizations simply told them something about the behavior of heat, current, and resistance that they had not known before. But more often, as discussion earlier in the book indicates, symbolic generalizations simultaneously serve a second function, one that is ordinarily sharply separated in analyses by philosophers of science. Like F equals MA or I equals V over R, they function in part as laws, but also in part as definitions of some of the symbols they deploy. Furthermore, the balance between their inseparable legislative and definitional force shifts over time. In another context, these points would repay detailed analysis, for the nature of the commitment to a law is very different from that of commitment to a definition. Laws are often corrigible piecemeal, but definitions, being tautologies, are not. For example, part of what the acceptance of Ohm's law demanded was a redefinition of both current and resistance. If those terms had continued to mean what they had meant before, Ohm's law could not have been right. That is why it was so strenuously opposed, as, say, the Joule-Lenz law was not. Probably that situation is typical. I currently suspect that all revolutions involve, among other things, the abandonment of generalizations, the force of which had previously been, in some part, that of tautologies. Did Einstein show that simultaneity was relative, or did he alter the notion of simultaneity itself? Were those who heard paradox in the phrase relativity of simultaneity simply wrong? Consider next a second type of component of the disciplinary matrix, one about which a good deal has been said in my original text under such rubrics as metaphysical paradigms or the metaphysical parts of paradigms. I have in mind shared commitments to such beliefs as heat is the kinetic energy of the constituent parts of bodies. All perceptible phenomena are due to the interaction of qualitatively neutral atoms in the void, or, alternatively, to matter and force, or to fields. Rewriting the book now, I would describe such commitments as beliefs in particular models, and I would expand the category models to include also the relatively heuristic variety. The electric circuit may be regarded as a steady-state hydrodynamic system. The molecules of a gas behave like tiny elastic billiard balls in random motion. Though the strength of group commitment varies, with non-trivial consequences along the spectrum from heuristic to ontological models, all models have similar functions. Among other things, they supply the group with preferred or permissible analogies and metaphors. By doing so, they help to determine what will be accepted as an explanation and as a puzzle solution. Conversely, they assist in the determination of the roster of unsolved puzzles and in the evaluation of the importance of each. Note, however, that the members of scientific communities may not have to share even heuristic models, though they usually do so. I have already pointed out that membership in the community of chemists during the first half of the 19th century did not demand a belief in atoms. A third sort of element in the disciplinary matrix I shall here describe as values. Usually, they are more widely shared among different communities than either symbolic generalizations or models, and they do much to provide a sense of community to natural scientists as a whole. Though they function at all times, their particular importance emerges when the members of a particular community must identify crisis, or later, choose between incompatible ways of practicing their discipline. Probably the most deeply held values concern predictions. They should be accurate, quantitative predictions are preferable to qualitative ones. Whatever the margin of permissible error, it should be consistently satisfied in a given field, and so on. There are also, however, values to be used in judging whole theories. They must